This is Dr. Arliss Wood. As a psychologist, I evaluate mental health in our American military. That's one of the things that I do. 10, 20, 50 years later, many of these soldiers who faced war still have all kinds of trauma and severe PTSD from their time in a war zone. Today, we have an entire population in Ukraine facing war conditions. We are going to speak with some courageous persons who are going to be talking to us from Ukraine, along with their support workers here in the United States in Bozeman, Montana. On behalf of KGVM 95.9 FM radio and KGVM.org and the Montana Psychological Association, we welcome this group. Dr. Suzanne Wood will now introduce our guests.
From the Annals of Medicine, June 2023. The Russia-Ukraine crisis has been at the center of our concerns since early in 2022. This conflict, bursting after the COVID crisis, creates really severe atmosphere for all of us of uncertainty and instability. Young Ukrainians have their hopes shattered for brighter days, and all Ukrainians suffer severe mental health trauma. Today, we share a way to reach out and connect with the efforts to help. So many of us here in America are deeply concerned for our friends in Ukraine. On our block alone, here in Bozeman, Montana, there are three homes flying Ukrainian flags. Let's welcome a very, very special group today from here in America and from all the way in Ukraine. Michael will welcome you first. Michael, tell us where you're sitting right now.
I am in my living room, and I am in Khmelnytsky, Ukraine. Which is the seat of the Khmelnytsky Oblast.
And did we hear you saying a few minutes ago that the alarm sirens were sounding?
That is correct.
And so that's a part of your daily life right now?
Correct, yes.
Kind of hard to get a grasp on from here, Michael. We applaud you so highly. And we have also with us some other guests. We have a critical care nurse, Barb, who hearkens from Arizona, and Michelle, an MSU architectural student and former veteran, and Dr. Alexandra Lewis-Lorenz and her husband, Kaz, of Central Washington University. All of these folks are here to talk about their efforts to help those in Ukraine, the many things needed, and how we here in Bozeman and Montana in the United States can also help. Welcome, one and all. We are so honored to have you with us, and we want to applaud with all of our hearts every aspect of your work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Maybe we could start with Michael. Where's home? How did you get there? What are you doing?
Home is here right now. I got rid of my apartment, got rid of my car, and came here. I'm here for, you know, as long as I can be effective and as long as I can, you know, keep getting the funding to be here. Home for me, I originally come from Florida. But through a series of life events, I ended up studying architecture at Montana State University. I planned on going back to Missoula, where I had been living, and pursuing architecture. But right at the end of the master's program, the woman that started our organization, Karolina Konechna, became extremely involved in providing aid for Ukrainians. And I had always said through school that I didn't want to build homes for rich people. That just didn't feel where my calling was. I wanted to use architecture for a more humanitarian thing, but I didn't know what that was. And right at the end of the master's program, this all happened. So it just seemed like a good opportunity, I don't know, for me to sell everything I had and go pursue this.
Tell us exactly what you're doing there.
We are following, I have long versions of all this stuff, and I can ramble on for a very long time about this, but I'll try to keep it short. We're following a program that a very astute mayor in a small town in an oblast near here started, which was recognizing that piling a bunch of IDPs and collective centers would not, and this is, you guys have a show that handles mental health, piling people in very close quarters for a very long time with all shared amenities starts to wear on you. So they recognize that as not a good situation for long-term solutions. So although they had collective centers in their city, they were trying to find new ways to solve housing for people that were going to be either long-term displaced or permanently displaced. So they started looking at all the buildings that they had in the city, the city's inventory. I and others and Michelle gave an assessment of those buildings and said they were not in good condition to provide humane housing. After we had left, they took a little bit of that and they worked with another group called CORE, which is Sean Penn's humanitarian aid organization, community-oriented relief effort or something like that. Them and a local nonprofit started renovating houses that were owned by people in the city, but that weren't unoccupied, or houses that IDPs were living in, but were in poor condition for, you know, again, long-term health.
And when you say IDP, what is an IDP?
Oh, sorry. An IDP, I had to learn this as well, is an internally displaced person.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
If they're a refugee, but they haven't left their country, and they're considered, and this is a UN term, and so that's an internally displaced person.
Thank you.
So all we're doing here is following that program type. So we're finding... we're working now, and we had started in Cochinchina, which is the name of that small town. We renovated seven houses in that immediate area. And then because that group CORE had done so many projects and had started an enormous project, they kind of took up the best projects in that area. And we were pursuing, you know, other relationships in another oblast right next to them, or to the Ternopil oblast where we were. So we decided to move to another oblast, which is here where I am now, to start doing that same project type. So we just started our first project in this area, which is renovating a house. For an IDP woman named Tetiana, she is about to give birth within under 2 weeks. And they are living in a house they have running water outside, but there's no running water inside. So there's no toilet, there's no shower, there's no kitchen sink, there's no septic on the property. Through our initial projects, had wondered, how do we know what to do? And I don't know, how am I doing on time? Because I have all this stuff.
Perfect. Laid
out. Okay, great. and we say we want to provide dignified housing, so we wanted to come up with a working definition of dignity, and then how does that turn into a shopping list? For, you know, a contractor to go through. So we set up a system of how to analyze a building, And so when we say dignity, we mean a certain set of things. And then that tells us we need a certain set of amenities to provide for dignity. So we nailed that down to being shelter, sanitation, nutrition, water, and power. So when we go to a building, we're looking for to first analyze a building for its structural integrity, and then also its ability to provide a clean indoor environment. And then we're looking for the types of amenities that provide for those living conditions that are conducive for dignity. And an enormous piece to dignity that we had in there was cleanliness, that we had noticed that some other organizations provided objects, like they would provide a stove or they would provide a toilet or whatever, but they didn't provide the systems that are not only effective for that, the operation of that object, but also for the clean indoor air quality of the operation of that object. So something like a stove is good, but it can also decrease the indoor air quality. Also, we found out the traditional way of making buildings here, you can provide windows, and new windows on old buildings guarantees the growth of mold inside during the wintertime. So we have, thanks to our wonderful education at Montana State University, architecture for us is not purely aesthetics. It has a building performance component, and it has a building health component as well. So again, if I can bring this back to the mental health of long-term living and being in a dignified environment, it requires that your air is clean and that the materials surrounding those places are cleanable. So, we'd provide a stove, but we're also, and a sink so people can wash, but we provide the backsplash as well so that people can clean that through time. Making sure that a stove always has a vent hood. Bathrooms always have vent fans. They don't always do that here. And I understand for cost reasons why, but the long-term implications of not having proper ventilation and not having cleanable materials leads to poor air quality. We analyze the buildings for the missing amenities and then provide those missing amenities. That takes a lot of design stuff, but then it also takes a lot of coordination with heads of municipalities, their IDP coordinators, finding the IDPs, working with home owners for them to consent to our works, but then taking that a step further and working with a contract with them to say that they will provide free housing to the IDPs for 1 or 2 years, depending on how much work we're doing, in exchange for these renovations. And then we have to develop a working relationship, a contractual working relationship with contractors for them to provide the services as we designed them, because we're not just throwing money around. We want to guarantee that the IDPs are living in the conditions that we intended. And it's been wonderful because, contractors may not have the greatest reputation for some of us in the United States. There's difficulties here. We're writing contracts to guarantee this stuff, but that's also not to say that there are enemies, because many of the contractors that we have worked with have given us wonderful feedback about, because a lot of them really care about IDPs and have helped IDPs as well themselves. So they give us feedback of, that's not how we would typically do things this way because it has this repercussion. So sometimes we've done a redesign, or they've given us feedback of, the house is in this kind of condition, so we're going to need to change the renovations this way. Anyway, so in a medium amount of time, that is what I am doing.
I have a quick question. Because, yes, Unfortunately, in a war, there are many single leaders of the household due to a partner being off in the war.
Correct.
Does that enter in? And also, unfortunately, there are different kinds of disabilities that come as a result of a war, do you have to make them accessible, the households?
Absolutely, and I'm really glad you brought that up. Accessibility is not thoroughly applied here in Ukraine, so we are having to find new ways to make sure that we're doing that. For instance, I mean, a great example of this is this IDP woman, Tatiana, who was about to give birth. Her husband is now has been mobilized, and so he is off fighting right now. And so, you know, we're not here just to do what we want. You know, we were very specific to talk to Tatiana about what exactly were her needs. You know, so do you want a walk-in shower, or do you want a tub for, you know, washing your children? We had one that had an elderly grandmother that usually would have, you know, her children there to help take care of her, but she was taking care of her granddaughter because the parents were left back near Bakhmut to continue working because they had to make money still. Most of our projects have had elderly people in them. So yes, we're considering accessibility, and that can be anything from changing out the front door, because sometimes the front doors are here are very difficult to navigate. You know, asking them what works best for them as far as bathing goes, and of course, following standards, American standards we're following European standards, whichever is the most appropriate, for accessibility, sizing, things like that. We haven't had to do anything specific. Well, there was one woman that was blind, but the family was taking care of that stuff.
Do you have quite a long waiting list, or are you keeping up pretty well with those who need this help?
I think there's two ways to answer that. One is the waiting list is infinite. I mean, I can only do so much work at a time. Right now, when we first were working with this town, Zhvanets, when we visited them the first time, and this is a very delicate thing that we have to handle, and I knew this, and we screwed it up a little bit one time, but when you're looking for projects to do, if you visit the houses a lot, you build their hope up a lot. And if you're building their hope up, building their hope up, building their hope up, and it just takes you a long time to get the money, that stings. So we went to Zhvanets, got our cameras, got our notebooks, went through, and we met with seven families of IDPs. One of them was living in a decent house and had all the amenities and everything. And they were like, we don't really need your help. So, okay, now we're down to six. So right now our list is six families long, and I'm working on number one of that. So now that we're completing this first, the initiation of this first one, which takes a bit of momentum and to get it started, then we can start planning how we handle these other five. We're also finding, and I hope I explain this well, some of the services that we need to, or that we are providing, have to all happen chronologically, and they all directly relate to each other, so we have to do them as a chunk. But if we take the entire town and take all of the services we need to provide, some of them can be provided kind of a la carte, like a roof repair or replacing windows or a door. Or if somebody has all of the infrastructure and they just need a stove, these ones can be done more a la carte. So right now we have the total of six houses that we have a bunch of repairs that need to be done, but then there's all these like little things that can also be done at different times. So we're trying to figure out how to manage all of that. So right now the list is six. We have been working with two other towns that have projects that fit right inside of our goals, we just can't onboard them right now.
So what is your funding base, Michael, if I could ask?
Right now, this project is funded by, I don't know how he feels about saying his name, so I won't, but a gentleman here in Bozeman, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong on this, everyone else, but I believe he is a retired dermatologist in Bozeman.
Yes.
But he's given, I think it's like 6 out of the 8 projects that we've done, he's financed. Is it that much? Something like that, including this one. Or it's been from our general fund. I think we've done 4 projects directly from our general fund, and he's funded the rest of them, which is quite a bit of money.
If we could take a minute, and maybe the ladies and others with us, and you could tell people out in the audience, just while we're talking about funding, how they might contribute to this. Just a quick segue, and we'll be right back to your discussion. Michelle or Barb or Alexandra, could you maybe give us a website or a contact point for those out there hearing Michael talk and seeing those families over in Ukraine who might want to send some support?
Yeah, we have you can donate directly online through our website. It's ukrainereliefeffort.org, and that's just all one word, no spaces. And then we also have an email. It's contact@ukrainereliefeffort.org. And you can donate right there. We have a PO box if you can mail a check.
That would be good. Post office box. Uh-huh.
And while Michelle is looking that up, we've done fundraisers here in Bozeman. We were part of the farmers market, and we went to Music on Main and have done a few things like that to try to just get our name out there and so people are aware that we exist here. But the majority of the fundraising, really, we don't make that much money doing that. It's mainly just to let people know that we're here. If they want to donate, doing it on the website is the best way.
Are there many other cities doing the same sort of thing, or is this pretty unique?
Probably almost every city in the U.S. is probably doing something similar, I think. We're not in contact with them. I just know that because I have people in other states who mention that. You know, what we do in Bozeman is... we focus a lot here while we're here on the medical part of things, getting medical supplies. You know, that's kind of what our thing is while Michael's over in Ukraine, you know, working hard, doing what he's doing. The Bozeman people, a lot of what we're trying to do is get medical supplies donated to us from hospitals that we can send to Ukraine.
Okay.
And I know that's significant. Something as simple as vaccinations in Ukraine. I read that only 40% of the people there have been able to get their vaccinations. And come to think of it, all this came up during COVID, which again, you need vaccinations. And they actually in 2021 had an outbreak of polio because the vaccinations weren't available. So... yes, any way we can help in these efforts to make sure any family could have a safe place to live. And I appreciate you giving us those contact points because I know many people would be interested in helping a little bit, a lot, however much they can. And I'd like you to repeat those again a little bit later in the show if you could. And I wanted to ask also... Michelle, you're an architectural student as well from MSU, and you were over there, and you've been a veteran. What do you see as something that we could realistically hope to help with in this effort?
Well, that's a loaded question.
Not too big there.
Oh my. Oh.
Should we go over and help Michael build? Should we just send money? Does he have a big enough crew? How can we interact with this story?
I think, honestly, right now, from what I know, which I'm quite into everything, from what I know, I think one of our biggest struggles is financing. Because even with more people, that's more work you can do, but it requires more money. Unfortunately, we are in a world ruled by finances. So I think that's kind of our biggest restriction with what we're capable of right now. But I mean, we always use volunteers. We have, you know, things here to sort through, I think.
So this is Alexandra, and one of the things, I'm not medical, I'm not architectural, I'm an anthropologist who would like to help make a difference here however I can for a variety of different reasons. But we have been getting a lot of medical donations, which is fantastic. But one of the biggest things for us is we get these donations, we inventory them, and then we need to ship them to the Ukraine. And that costs money. And for the first year of the war, a lot of the airlines were letting people fly between the United States and Europe, right?
Poland.
Yeah. And then you can take a certain amount of baggage free. And so a number of, like, here, Barbara on my right here, she went to the Ukraine and took, how many boxes did you take?
We took 5 50-pound boxes each as carry-on of medical supplies. And Michelle did it as well. And yeah. I think what 6 of us went, or 6 of you guys went the first time, and then I think there were 5 of us the second time. And so what we're trying to do on this end of things, along with architectural stuff, is, you know, the Ukrainians are in dire need of medical supplies for their soldiers, for their frontline people, for the IDPs that have, you know, been displaced and going to other cities. The hospitals are overrun. And so we're getting expired donated things from the hospitals and getting them over to Ukraine. And I read recently 20,000 people are on a list for artificial limbs. You were asking Michael about whether they need, you know, specialty housing and things. There's 20,000 people waiting for an artificial limb. And so, you know, we're focusing on trying to help them do that. We had a wonderful organization in Butte that was donated. They closed down and they were a medical supply place. And we got a 26-foot U-Haul truck to pick up what they donated to us. And so we have, you know, crutches and wheelchairs and braces and things like that that we're desperately trying to get over there, because along with housing, they need just basic things. And you know, what we, our hospital system in the United States, we, you know, as you know, because you're both doctors, we throw away everything that's expired. So we gather that stuff up from places that donate, and that's saving their lives. You know, we're getting dressings, we're getting, you know, like everything that they could possibly need, and we can get it to the front line. So that's one of our big focuses here in Bozeman, along with, you know, the wonderful work that the architects are doing. That's kind of part two of our organization, is getting medical supplies over there.
Well, I love both parts, because I found out in studying this that up till April 2022 during this war, there have been 157 attacks on healthcare facilities. So when you say you're providing basics, I think every one of those bandages or vaccine serums is pure gold, just pure gold, and just the heartfulness to carry them in boxes to the airplane and take them over yourselves. That's a really strong effort right there. So in going back to Michael, Michael, do you need more people to work on your crew making these careful renovations, or do local people make those changes to the structures? How does that work?
So, yes, we directly hire contractors to do the physical work. I know how to swing a hammer, but they build everything out of bricks. So my, you know, skill as somebody who can design and, you know, read up on code and best practices and think about indoor air quality, that, you know, I'm trying to stick just inside of that. As Michelle mentioned, our big bottleneck is money. If we were, you know, if somebody said, here's $100,000, I would have to hire people. Here's the thing, though, is I can do my job relatively quickly. The stuff, you know, the architecture stuff. And I will say, I am not a licensed architect in the United States. I have a master's degree in architecture, and I have, you know, a decent amount of construction experience and material production experience. I am not, I'm 33, so I'm not, you know, a 25-year-old coming out of a master's program. I can do that stuff quickly. It took me a week and a half to learn how to write and actually produce a cost estimate for this house. That was a very difficult thing, but it would have been much more helpful to have, you know, an accountant with me to kind of work through the systems. And I mean, even if it was just an Excel spreadsheet guru, that would have been, you know, very helpful and probably made things a little quicker. Legal services are another one. We took a class on professional practice, and so, you know, a lawyer gave me a framework of what a contract needs to be here, and I had to add in all of the architectural pieces to that. You know, she could write out, you know, everything that a lawyer knows about a contract, but what happens when the contractor doesn't do what I ask them to do? What are the repercussions with that? Okay, well, Mike Everett's taught us that in pro practice. So if I can name drop, yes, I did pay attention. you know, so I spend a lot of time not drawing. So it's not just architecture people. And I have a lot of help. I have another alumni here as well, Britt Andrews, who helps me, and he's doing an enormous amount of work on, like, you know, we have a website, and we're trying to get the architecture stuff on their, you know, portfolios, and, you know, the stuff that I described with words, we're developing the diagrams and the charts and stuff like that to explain what our humanitarian goals are, what our processes are, so that people can understand and hopefully trust our process and believe in that a little bit more. So he's been working very hard on working with some graphic designers to develop that. I mean, a project manager would probably go a long way. Just somebody that could tell me what to do every day. I spent a lot of time with, you know, notebooks and Trello. And, you know, we've tried, you know, a bunch of all the 50 bazillion things Michael has to do in a day. So just somebody to, yeah, hold my hand and, you know, okay, here you got to do this, and this, and today you got to do that. So yeah, it's not just a bunch of architects that we need. It takes a lot of things just to get a building built. Now I also have, not to segue too much, but the translator that I had here, Diana, is actually flying to Bozeman as we speak, and she would be a wonderful person for you to interview, not just about, because she could give you, you know, all the stories of Michael, but then also mental health issues in a war context. She's had, you know, issues with mental health before the war, and then the war happens, and it's had an extreme effect on her. And she can give, you know, stories of not just her, but her family and the mental health strain that just having the constant news bombardment on you has. yeah, she would be a wonderful person to interview. She's a very wonderful woman. So having a translator, and she helped me immensely. I mean, she was there at the beginning, the Vivat Hotel, where it all started.
What is your concern? Do you have any concerns about your security? One of the others mentioned by giving out a phone number, they had even received death threats. So do you have to be concerned about your security?
I have not. And, you know, I've heard here that the crime rate in the town that we started in, the crime rate went to like zero during the war. We're in a big city now, and I'm an amateur photographer, and I like to walk around and take photos of things. And I've never felt in danger because of that stuff. I think I've heard one explosion here, and that was them shooting down a missile or a drone or something like that. We did hear the, it wasn't anti-aircraft, but the anti-missile systems one morning. I don't know if I'm an idiot or if I just, you know, handle stress pretty well, but I don't feel stressed out by, you know, my danger, and no one has reached out to me, threatening my life or my family
good,
or anything.
Good.
We do see that stress and depression are kind of rampant in a war situation, and also that those coming there even to provide mental health services, it's very devastating for them as well to take care of themselves in order to be able to help others. And Michael, how do you keep up your spirits so well? It sounds like you're able to stay focused. And when we started this call, the air raid sirens were going off. And so how do you keep such a positive outlook?
Yeah, the stress does get to me sometimes, and you can ask the people around me. I don't yell at anybody, but, you know, you just get irritated by things and the stress and, you know, wondering about where, you know, the money for me living here, you know, I'm not living paycheck to paycheck, but, you know, the kind donations of family and friends, you know, has brought me this far. Some of those donors are having, you know, life-changing things in their lives and, you know, have stopped donating so much. So, like, I have to, you know, start thinking about that and whatever. Anyway, so I think the number one thing that I do is I like to go for walks and take photos of things. And it takes me out of the headspace of, you know, work. And just looking for simple beauty in things, looking for, the small things, the way a shadow casts on. If you go for a walk with me, I'll point at, look at the beautiful light over there, or look at the way the shadow is on that building, or, you know, there's a this arrangement or that. And I just geek out about that stuff and I really enjoy it. So, I am putting together, not to be pretentious, but I'm a film photographer, and so I brought the film developing stuff with me because I knew that, you know, having some kind of a hobby means having some kind of a break, a little bit of rest time. I've been working with another person who also is a film photographer here, and we're putting together like a little book, you know, of some of the things, you know, our walks and things, and we're writing in there of like, this is what you're seeing here are the images of us seeking rest. And so it's, you know, walking through, the in-between places of cities and on the outskirts and in between villages and things. And it's every type of weather. And so, yeah, that's kind of my therapy session, I guess.
Excellent. We wanted to ask, Barb, our critical care nurse, we read that Doctors Without Borders is providing mental health support in the community. Do you know much about that and how many they're able to reach? And Michael, have you been able to hear about them or to reach out for perhaps counseling or support from Doctors Without Borders?
Personally, I know nothing about what they are doing.
Okay.
They're a completely different organization, obviously, than we are. So I know that there's numerous organizations that are trying to provide mental health to the, you know, the people who are affected over there. So, that's not my organization, I guess.
I just thought, you know, that with mental health being such a concern that, you know, that we could touch on that, particularly with Michael over there in the midst of everything.
Can I just real quick? I think because as far as like we go with the medical stuff that we supply is more of like a physical nature. I think the mental health that we try to address is through the architecture.
Okay, through your work. Okay, that seems very healthy. It's serving Michael well, it seems. Yes.
I will say, Can I add to this that, you know, there are many communities looking for spaces that they can provide mental health. So a lot of the communities that we've talked with want to build a either a veteran care clinic or a mental health clinic for IDPs. The town we were in, Copichincy, they made a few social spaces for IDPs. They work with after school programs with their school for IDP children, you know, to help integrate and socialize them. And community integration is, I think, is a goal that the leadership in Copichincy, Mayor Bogdan Kalichavi and his crew are really pushing for community integration because they are thinking about mental health. And so there's another program or another organization, Ukrainian organization called Poshmishka, which means smile in Ukrainian. And they're located, they have an organization head center in Copichincy. And they've been doing a lot of things. They focus on, what would that be? Mothers, children, and elderly, I believe. And they've provided help with some of the IDPs living in the houses that we've renovated. I met one gentleman who worked in Doctors Without Borders, and I believe they are much more focused on much closer to the front lines. We are pretty far away from the front lines. I think we're like a 12-hour drive from the front lines.
Thank goodness. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And a lot of, I think some of that aid is missing here as far as what I've seen, the mental health stuff. Not to say that it's not, that there aren't great things being done near the front lines, but a lot of people have been displaced into the inter part of the country. You know, I've thought about, is there a way that you could do online, you know, mental health and things like that. But I think a lot of people in a lot of places are looking for the physical spaces that people can go to seek.
That would always be wonderful to
or
have.
Or to seek rest.
In the midst of that, I think I read that the Doctors Without Borders have sponsored something like 8,000 mental health consultations in seven different regions of Ukraine online. So they're trying to do teletherapy when possible. But again, you need a location for that. You need a site to be able to sit and do that, which would fall back into your architectural range, that maybe even just a clinic with a screen where people could go for an hour and have their therapy session and then move on to the next person. So there could be more than one way architecturally and psychologically to present services.
Yeah. Can I just add something here? Because this is Alexandra. I actually wrote a short article on URE and what we're doing and who's involved.
And one of the things I did was ask Michael to tell me why he's doing what he's doing and what it is he's doing. And one of the things that he wrote back, which I thought was really fascinating, and maybe this addresses your comment on mental health, is that people will actually opt to live in a place that doesn't have running water, that doesn't have toilets, that doesn't have showers, doesn't have a kitchen, even doesn't have electricity, so that they can live in places where they have their friends, where they have markets, where they have this social interaction. And one of the things about the architectural component of URE is that that is what they are looking at. That is the whole focus. I'm not an architecture student, so I don't know who taught that class, but whatever. It makes, as a cultural anthropologist, it makes a huge amount of sense.
Yes, I will. There's a ton of buildings that we could renovate out here, but we are specific to look for, if we're looking for houses without people in them, we're not going to renovate houses out in the middle of nowhere. We're not going to renovate houses in dangerous parts of town. Community integration is clearly a component of these people's health and their livelihood, the dignity that's involved. So, we've been shown quite a few buildings in villages that their population is dwindling, or they don't have a hospital nearby, or they don't have schools. So finding places and making sure that we're doing our efforts in places that have ways that the communities can integrate, I think is an absolute critical thing. So it's not just, point at a building and I'll renovate it, but there's a component of choosing how that building is situated in a culture.
The connectivity, the old-fashioned concept of neighborhood is all very, very completely, mentally, as a big prerequisite to stability.
Absolutely, yeah. People don't need buildings. they need the things that buildings provide. So that includes location. Sorry, Barb.
No, that's okay. Yeah, no, this is Barbara. I just wanted to mention, because, we also had been in Ukraine for a couple of weeks, that one of the things that I noticed as a nurse, and, I've traveled the world a bit and worked with different cultures as well, is that safety is a huge thing. People are going from, running literally for their lives and, with the shirt on their back and nothing else. So, the mental health part of it is incredibly important, but the physical safety part is equally as important. They're leaving. One of the people we helped renovate a house for, she told us that they left in the middle of the night, she and her teenage son. The Russians came and took over their town. And so they left in the middle of the night and just basically ran through the woods. And, her husband, she met up with her husband later. So the physical part of it is as important as the mental health part of it. Is just providing a safe spot for them. When we were in Kopenchansi, one of the places that we toured was renovated. What was it? Where the kids are at the school, elementary school, and they had a bomb shelter that every time the air raid sirens went off, the kids had to go down for at least a couple of hours into the bomb shelter. And so it takes a physical as well as mental toll on them. And they are providing, things like clothing and food. And that's one thing our organization is doing as well, as some of the money that we raise. We're also, helping an orphanage and helping get, basic supplies for people. So, it's a physical thing as well as a mental thing.
Well, I think we play on each other. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Physical health has to come even prior to mental health. We need to make sure of physical safety primarily, and then, work toward mental health. I'm so glad you mentioned that, and I think we all should keep mentioning that, even though we sometimes just assume that.
I've heard a lot about the children that have been kidnapped, basically, and taken to Russia. Is there much awareness of that in that area where you are, Michael, or that you all have noticed?
You know, I don't hear of that, so I can't speak on that.
Okay.
I think most of the kidnappings that are happening from what I've read and my understanding are closer to the front lines. Mm-hmm. In the towns that have been taken over by the Russians.
Okay.
So, yeah.
And so, Michael, the town where you are, it hasn't really been bombed yet or just minimally. So the housing work that you're doing would be in those areas that did have some war damage, or is it just helping the people in that area who came from other parts to be there?
I guess there's a few layers with that. The city that I am in, Khmelnytsky, there's a military base here in the city. There's some infrastructure. The military base has been bombed here. I think about a month before we arrived, there were some enormous explosions. I have not seen a residential building or, commercial building here bombed, but before we got here, there was some large military stuff that was bombed, some infrastructural things. I believe the train tracks were bombed at some point. So the city that I am in has received a decent amount. The places that we are doing our work are, in villages and in not remote as in, the middle of nowhere, but much more dispersed, population. So that's where we are focusing. So the work that we are doing is, secure in that. And that's why, it's interesting. I don't want to come here and tell IDPs what they ought to do. It's interesting to find where they are. Like Alexandra pointed out, people are choosing to live without these amenities so they have security and community. So we're going to where they are and helping them in the decisions that they've made as to what's important. And we're giving them the humanitarian environments with that. We have been working with the leadership, the regional leadership of the organization MedAir. They've partnered with us on quite a few projects. They're partnering with us on this project. They reached out to me a couple weeks ago. They're actually connected in with the UN. They're part of the UN's, the UN wants to provide integrated assistance. All categories of the aid that's needed, and MedAir is plugged into that the housing component. They approached me because there's an oblast to the north of here that did have the invasion come through there and destroy a bunch of housing, and they asked me if we could head up the new construction stuff that they need because they've been providing windows, doors, patching roofs, installing a bathroom here or a water heater there, but not doing larger scale things. And they looked at what we were doing and how we were doing that, and they liked that and asked us, and it's probably pushing into 2024 that this will come up, but they're asking us to preliminarily, and I'm not counting my chickens before they hatch, getting too excited. But if the opportunity does come up and we can finish up the work that we have lined up for us in Zhvanets, then we would look forward to working in an area that has received direct damage due to the war.
That's quite a consideration. That would be amazing too, along with finishing up those efforts that you have there at home. We really thank Michael, Barb, Michelle, Dr. Alexandra and Kaz. We're getting closer to the end here. Are there any things that we haven't brought up in our final 3 minutes or so here that we need to mention? I'd like to save time to give that website again and the contact information for folks to help out with this.
Well, we would like to just draw your attention to the fact that we are a 501c, so we're a nonprofit organization, and that we are all of us are volunteers. We've all got lots of other things going on, and the volunteers here in the United States, a lot of us in this room are focused on the medical supplies, and we spend a lot of time packing, inventorying, and our biggest problem is getting stuff to the Ukraine. We can get it. We need to get it to New Jersey so that we can get it shipped directly to the Ukraine. And any help that people could give us in that direction will be really greatly appreciated.
We have a Ukrainian shipping company in New Jersey that can send the supplies that we gather directly to Ukraine. So our challenge at the moment, because we can't use the airlines anymore, is getting things from Bozeman to New Jersey is quite expensive with U-Haul and that kind of thing. So any help with that would be greatly appreciated. Is saving people's lives. The supplies that we're gathering are sitting here because we can't get them over there at the moment. So, that would be wonderful.
Surely those people out in the audience listening will want to help with this, particularly if they have a cousin with a big truck or they have knowledge of medical supplies that might be available. So let's give the website and the contact information again.
Okay. So again, we are the Ukraine Relief Effort, also called URE. We're located in Bozeman, Montana, for the most part, and other places. it's ukrainereliefeffort.org. That's all one word, ukrainereliefeffort.org. We have an email at contact@ukrainereliefeffort.org. And we also have a P.O. Box, which is P.O. Box 3043 in Bozeman, Montana. And that zip code is 59772.
And we also have Facebook and Instagram. And if anybody would like to follow what we're doing, we post a lot of our things that we're up to on Facebook or Instagram. So you can see a little bit more real time what we're up to.
We'd like to thank you all and the listening audience for listening to this program. And please turn your money, your efforts, your volunteerism toward this effort. And we'd like to let you know that this program will be aired on Monday evenings at 7 o'clock in the near future, and also on Thursday mornings at 9 on KGVM 95.9 FM and KGVM.org. And if you go to KGVM.org, you can look at other programs. You can scroll down and go to past archives of other programs, and this one will be there. It can be listened to as many times as you wish and hopefully be used to gather more volunteer effort, particularly financially. Please go to this website, use this method to to give, and I'm sure you can volunteer and give time as well. And as they mentioned, if you own a truck company and you have extra space, please contact this group so they can put supplies to New Jersey to be sent without great financial destruction in order to get the materials there. Again, thank you all. Thank this group particularly. Continue to listen to Health and Happiness.
Michael, stay well. We really appreciate
stay well, Michael.
Getting up so early to visit with us. We'll hope to talk to you again soon.